Dip, 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 dip. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la, puddle. Sha-la-la-la, sha-la-la-la. Good evening. This is the Labor Exchange, and I'm Dennis Kreese, a member of the Board of Area Labor Council, AFL-CIO. Please note, the following show is from a previous Labor Exchange radio show from Monday, August 5th, 2019. At that time, the subject was Organized Labor in the Trump Administration, Part 3. Special guest at that time was Dr. Ray Hoegler, Labor Law Professor Emeritus and Professor of Management Emeritus, Colorado State University, and also Fulbright Distinguished Chair of Labor Law from the University of Tuscany, Italy, 2007. Ray, great to have you back on the show.
Hey, thank you for inviting me, Dennis.
Ray, as always, let's do just a quick, for our listening audience, background update. So as per our last interview, which was January 7th, congratulations for this KGNU listening audience, especially our new and younger listening members. Could you share your impressive academic journey, starting from your days as an undergraduate at Fort Lewis College, Durango, Colorado, then CU Boulder, to your recent retirement after a long time at CSU?
Yeah, thank you, Dennis. I mean, it's been quite a journey. And as you said, I started out in this very small liberal arts college down in Durango. Then I was able to study for a year in Atlanta, Georgia, at Emory University. I did that on a Woodrow Wilson fellowship. Then I came to the University of Colorado. I got a PhD in English. It took me a while to figure this out. I got a PhD in English. And then I went on to get a law degree from the University of Colorado. And I have to say, it wasn't entirely accidental. It's just when I got out of graduate school with a degree in English, there weren't very many jobs. So I retreaded myself like a lot of people at that time and went to law school. So that's my journey, Dennis, and here I am retired.
Great, Ray. Let's get into the content and the subject of the show, Organized Labor in the Trump Administration. So let's begin with Eugene Scalia, new Secretary of Labor. Who is Eugene Scalia, and why should all workers and their families, especially union members, be concerned with this appointment? And beyond that, what is his background as an attorney in the areas of labor and employment?
Well, actually, he's the son of Antonin Scalia, the former Supreme Court Justice. He's an interesting guy, and he's interesting because he's a little more moderate, I think, in some senses than his father. On the other hand, he was a government appointee for the Department of Labor. He worked as a solicitor, and he worked for a management-side law firm. And as you know, Dennis, in labor relations, you generally work for one side or the other, either management or labor, unless you happen to be an arbitrator, and then you're a neutral. But if you're an active advocate, you work for one side or the other. So he's worked for this very well-known law firm in Washington, Gibson, Dunn, and Crutcher, and they represent employers in labor relations matters. I looked him up a little bit, and one of the newspaper comment about Scalia, they said in Mother Jones, Barney Frank said, there are ideologues who want to kill the rules. They can't say they're unconstitutional. They're doing this because it's the only possible way to knock them out. And he was commenting about Eugene Scalia. He said the best way to do it is put them in these government positions. And what I thought was interesting, just to wrap up this little, this little discussion, is they asked Scalia to comment on this, Eugene Scalia, and he declined to comment. So I think Barney Frank's comment is appropriate.
All right, then, Ray, let's get into this. For those that are not familiar with cabinet positions, but the U.S. Department of Labor, what are some of the primary functions of the U.S. Department of Labor, and could you provide some background as to why and when it was created?
Yeah, it was created in 1913. It's interesting to me, the first Secretary of Labor was a guy named William Wilson. No relation of the President Wilson, but he was appointed, and he came out of a trade union background. He was a union president. I forget which international union, but he was very into the labor side. He became labor secretary. There's a Colorado connection here because in 1914, in the Ludlow Massacre, Wilson personally came out to Colorado to investigate the Ludlow Massacre and Rockefeller's role in it. So he was a very, I think, active and knowledgeable person they had up the Department of Labor. And the purpose of the department, I looked up their mission, is to foster, promote, and develop the welfare of working people, to improve their working conditions, and to advance their opportunities for profitable employment. So they're oriented toward workers and labor. That's why it's the Department of Labor, not the Department of Employers.
Ray, how does this appointment, Eugene Scalia, quote-unquote, fit into President of the United States' Trump policy agenda? And beyond that, does this mean a right-wing shift towards corporate interests? And if so, why?
I think it does indicate that shift. Usually speaking, for the Department of Labor, as I said before, they tend to be union advocates and labor advocates, and Scalia is definitely not. The purpose of the Department of Labor, as I said, is to advocate the interest of workers, and I don't think that he really has workers' interest at heart. On the other hand, you can say, well, he's very knowledgeable about employment law. Probably is, but as I said before, that department is oriented toward labor. I think what's important to this political agenda is the interest of workers. I read a note in the New York Times, an article about it, in which the writer, Stephen Greenhouse, who's their labor correspondent, said the United States is the only advanced industrial nation that doesn't have national laws guaranteed paid maternity leave. It's also the only advanced economy that doesn't guarantee workers any vacation, paid or unpaid, and the only highly developed country other than South Korea that doesn't guarantee paid sick days. So we have a lot of areas where legislation and activism on the part of the Department of Labor might improve a lot of working people in the United States. It's highly unlikely that Eugene Scalia is going to be a forceful advocate for any of this.
I agree. And just one thing that came into my mind, I was a history major, undergraduate, but I believe it was with FDR, whether it was his first or second administration, he appointed Frances Perkins, a woman, first cabinet position. I don't remember that, but maybe you do.
Yes, you're absolutely correct, Dennis. If you go to the website, which I reviewed, Frances Perkins was the first woman cabinet member, I believe, in the United States. She was a very, very active and forceful and influential cabinet member. She was a sociology major. Yeah, she was.
Yeah.
And she left her mark on the Department of Labor. They named the official building back there in Washington is named after her. She really was one of the landmark Department of Labor officials. I would add that maybe along with Ray Marshall, she was probably one of the most knowledgeable and influential, impactful Department of Labor secretaries we've had.
Yeah, I'm glad I remembered that and threw that out. I get my good moments. Anyway, Ray, the National Labor Relations Board, also known as the NLRB. Again, could you discuss, update President of the United States Trump's appointments to the NLRB? And as before, could you explain some of the adverse consequences that are already apparent in recent NLRB decisions?
Just a little background about the board, Dennis. I mean, this is the operation on the ground for workers' rights in the United States. They were created by the National Labor Relations Act. They're designed to handle worker issues, voting for unions, and unfair labor practice charges. They're basically the first contact that workers have with the federal government, and they're the advocate for workers. The Labor Board was founded in 1935. The name of the unofficial name of the act is the Wagner Act, because it was written by Robert Wagner, who served as the first chair. And Wagner was very active in all of this. Wagner used to go around the country and preside over hearings where workers would come and make complaints about their employers and how they had stifled unions. So Wagner knew everything about it. And when he sat down to draft the act, he and his aide, a guy named Leon Kaiserling, did everything in their power to make sure that this was oriented toward protecting workers' rights. Now, it was modified in 1947 to become a little more pro-employer, to balance it out, as Congress said at that point in time. But it remains the backbone of federal labor law in the United States.
Well, the appointments. You know, he's had recent appointments, and they've made some decisions, which I call, I think you agreed at last interview, adverse consequences, present tense.
Yes, and what's happened is because these appointees are political appointees, they list them as Republican appointees or Democratic appointees. And these Republican appointees have made several decisions which really they have consequences for workers. Not to get into the weeds too much about this, but there are decisions about bargaining units, and that's important because workers organize in a particular group. The board has the power to declare something is or is not an appropriate bargaining unit. So if they say a little category of workers can split off from the others, that means that the union is basically made up of a very small cadre. If they say no, that you have to organize everybody, then it makes it more difficult for unions to organize. We talked about this earlier. One of the issues at Yale was who got to be in a bargaining unit, just graduate teaching assistants in a particular department or graduate teaching assistants throughout the university. And they said that it was the larger unit, which in effect forced them to give up because they didn't have the support of all students. So the idea of a bargaining unit is very important. That's one of the important things the board does. And so those are some of the decisions. They may appear to be kind of technical, but what actually happens is the incremental effect of all these decisions is to create an environment where it makes it harder to unionize.
All right, then, Ray, let's move into this, really important wage growth. So could you give an update on lagging wage growth for all workers and their families, especially union members, workers here in the state of Colorado and throughout the United States? And I will add to, with the most recent Department of Labor report for this last month that wage growth went up 3.2%. For me personally, when they throw that out and say, oh, that's really good, I don't think that's very impressive at all.
Actually, it's not, because wage growth has been a lot higher than that in the past administrations. I looked it up in 2014, for example. Wage growth was higher than it is now. Even though Trump talks about all of this increase in the economic activity, but based on what I read in the statistics, even now, a lot of middle-class people don't think that Trump is helping them very much. So wages may be going up, but for that to get passed down to where people feel in their paychecks, that hasn't happened yet. And it may. I mean, it looks like things are on the uptick, but on the other hand, that's not true. And I just read this note from Bloomberg in this article. Trump has been telling voters wages are already rising at historic rates, though economic data don't show it. He has falsely claimed that wages are going up for the first time in 18 years, 19 years, etc. So he makes a lot of claims. The trouble is a lot of them are not backed up by the evidence.
No surprise. I mean, he does it every day.
yeah.
Anyway, why is this a serious problem for all workers trying very hard every day to meet their basic needs of food, clothing, housing, medical needs, etc.?
Well, because I think Trump got elected on that promise. If you remember during a campaign, he kept talking about the fact that economic performance in the United States was dismal. He said the economy I forget exactly how he characterized it, but he said it was in tatters, it was ruined, it was terrible. So he comes into office, and in fact, growth has been less under his administration than was previous to that. Nonetheless, he will still talk about the tremendous achievements of his administration. I think it's hard to know, and I think it's in fact so now finely detailed. I mean, people hear all this, and they may say, well, yeah, for me it is, for me it's not. And what happens as a result of that, these economic data get very muddied. I mean, people really, they hear things, but I don't think it has the impact it used to. When they said, oh, wages went up 3%, people would say, oh, yeah, that's right, and I got it in my paycheck. But that's not true as a universal matter anymore. So Trump's claims about the economy, I think, just make it harder to understand what's really happening.
Let's talk quickly about what we had a conversation with last week. The federal minimum wage at $7.25, the U.S. House of Representatives have passed a bill to raise it to 15 by 2024, which is, you know, modest by my standards. But the 40s, correct me if I'm wrong, I believe it's 46 million workers that work at the minimum wage, and that's 22% of the workforce. And now Mitch McConnell at the U.S. Senate, he won't even give this, you know, piece of legislation a hearing or a vote. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that's a shame. Why is Mitch McConnell opposing the minimum wage? I think the only answer is because there are powerful political interests out there, like restaurants and hotel owners and corporate interests, who say, we don't want to have this minimum wage. We think it's bad. And they have a storyline about that. Their storyline is, if we pass increases in minimum wage, we'll get higher inflation. That's bad for the economy. That's bad for everybody. Most economists, I think, these days would disagree with that. There's plenty of slack to be able to raise a minimum wage. Why doesn't he do it? I think he's beholden to certain factions, political factions, and he doesn't want to do it. And the truth is, raising the minimum wage is a very contentious thing, and it hasn't been done for some period of time now, and it doesn't look like it's going to happen as long as Republicans control the Senate. In fact, McConnell said as much. You send this stuff over here, it'll disappear. They won't even act on it.
All right, did right.
My question would, I was just going to add, why is Mitch McConnell suddenly king of legislation that most people in this country would like to have considered? And he won't even take it up for debate.
All right, in line with this, Ray, let's move into this. Income inequality. Unions were a major force for economic equality in this country from 1947 to 1978. Since that time, 1979 to 2019, 40 years, unions declined and subsequently led to our present situation of quote-unquote massive income inequality. As for our previous interviews, could you present some reasons, economic and political, for this time frame and, you know, this particular issue?
Well, this is very interesting. People write about these periods all the time. My own view is, right after World War II, productivity took off in this country. And as productivity increased, workers got real wage gains. That was because there were strong unions like the United Auto Workers out there bargaining for wage increases that actually put money in workers' pockets. That started to change in the late 1970s. In the late 1970s, we entered this period of stagflation. We entered this period of economic doldrums, if you will. And then in 1980, Ronald Reagan runs for president. He gets elected on a platform, I'm going to make America great once again. And what he did essentially was to curtail union power. He started out with the air traffic controllers. That sort of anti-union attitude percolates through the economy. Employers in the 1980s generally said, we are through paying these wage increases. We're no longer going to be beholden to unions and their bargaining demands. And as a result of that, real wages begin to atrophy. And once that bit down. And once that took hold, really until the administration of Bill Clinton, when wage growth started to come back again, that was the period where workers really suffered the worst in this country, and so did labor unions. The period from 1980 to 1990, there's only one period in recorded American history of labor that was worse for union membership, and that was 1920 to 1930. So this was a terrible time for workers, 1980 to 1990. As a result of that, they suffered dramatically in terms of incomes and real wages. Personally, I think that leads us right down to the road where we are right now. We're still talking about that.
So it definitely is intertwined with and having a negative effect on wage growth, meaning that what's coming up is not making a difference.
No, and I would just say, I mean, maybe I overstate it in too broad a terms, but the decline of unions in the United States, I think, is directly responsible for the rise of Trump. As these people who in lower wage income, non-college educated white workers who are the backbone of Trump supporters suffered the most decline in real wages during this period of time. As a result, they're unhappy and disgruntled.
Well, that's a good segue for this. Trump tax cuts. How has the tax cuts implemented by President of the United States Trump disproportionately benefit the wealthy? And what is and what will be the impact on the middle class workers and their families in the context for sustained prosperity?
Yeah, this is the interesting thing. I looked up some data about this one, too, and it's clear that these tax cuts are differentially benefiting higher income brackets. I think the problem is that it's going to continue to fuel this inequality in the United States, which, in my opinion, drives a lot of this political furor. People are not happy, but they're not happy because they have what they perceive to be bad economic consequences or for a period of time suffered that. I don't think Trump is going to be able to do anything, particularly these tax cuts, which benefit not middle-class income workers, but higher wage earners. They're going to receive the benefits of these tax cuts, and just to add on to this a little bit, one of the problems that Republicans always raised during the Obama administration was the problem of the deficit. Now they're giving these tax cuts, and if you read the literature on it, these tax cuts alone are probably going to be responsible for adding over $1 trillion to the deficit. So where are all these deficit hawks now? Why aren't they out there raising the issue about tax cuts? And the answer is they don't care anymore. And what they care about is media gratification of their base. And by giving tax cuts to this certain cohort of people in the United States, they're going to achieve that. Down the road, somebody's going to pay for it, but it won't be these guys.
Ray, let's move into this. And got about 5 minutes, and I want to try to cover about three more questions. But this one, the only political issues question I'm asking, and that is, Democrats regain majority control of the U.S. House of Representatives, yet Republicans retain majority of the U.S. Senate. This is all from the 2018 election. Beyond this, in spite of this, how will President of the United States Trump's judicial and administrative appointees guarantee an anti-union climate for the immediate future, even if he's impeached or defeated in 2020?
Yeah, the problem is, if he's impeached or defeated, he still leaves behind his legacy of federal judicial appointments and a Supreme Court that is tilted toward employers. There's no doubt about that. I think as a result of that, his legacy is going to live far beyond whatever his term might turn out to be. And the issue with this, administrative agencies like the National Labor Relations Board, they have a turnover. These people have specified terms of 5 years. They could be reappointed, but they can't stay forever. Problem with federal judges is they can stay forever. And you appoint somebody like Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court, a relatively young guy, he's going to be there forever and ever. And as a result of that, the judiciary is going to continue to be slanted, in my view, toward employer interest and issues.
And federal judge, they're lifetime appointments. They're not term limited. Is that correct?
That's what I said. I mean, the board, if you get a new Democratic president in the next election, there'll be retirees on the board that roll off their terms, and that president can then reappoint new people. Not so with federal judges. I mean, they stay there until they're 100 years old or whatever how they're still functional. I mean, Oliver Wendell Holmes is in his 90s sitting on the Supreme Court. These guys ain't going to leave. I mean, Kavanaugh's got another 40 years.
Ray, let's get into a summary. President of the United States Trump was elected by a massive turnout and support by non-college educated white workers. Some examples are from Wisconsin, Michigan, my home state, Pennsylvania, and there's other states as well. With good reason, they were very angry with their economic status. For the 2020 election, what could change this mindset? What can these workers do?
Well, this is very interesting, Dennis. I mean, I looked it up again, and Hillary Clinton won the popular vote by over 2 million votes. Trump eked out a victory, which, according to most people, was simply a fluke. He managed to capture the electoral college vote in key industrial states like Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Ohio. And he did that by picking off this disaffected group of former union members, if you will, working people, white working class voters. So the election was tilted toward him by the Electoral College. He didn't win the vote. He keeps talking about being a popularly elected president or the president with the most votes. That's completely untrue. He did win the Electoral College, but it was with these key states. And to me, the very interesting issue is how come the base in these states, which traditionally voted Democratic and were good union members, as you know, how come they suddenly turned for Trump? And I think that's economic dissatisfaction. But it wasn't. Trump won a landslide across the United States with his policies and whatever he said. It was a fact that he was able to turn these key states and win the Electoral College. So I don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah, we'll see.
I don't think anybody does.
We'll see what happens. He still has a 41-42% support rate with this base. That's a large number. So, Ray, we got about a minute. So we got to finish up.
Sure.
Do you have any final thoughts or comments for this KGNU listening audience in the context of this evening's subject, organized labor in the Trump administration?
Yes, I think it's going to be very interesting to see how the organized labor movement turns out. The official voice of the organized labor movement, the AFL-CIO, has come out against Trump. To me, the interesting thing is going to be to see if they can sway or influence the membership of organized labor to be able to really get out the vote and to turn that vote in favor of opposition to Trump. We'll see if that happens. I don't know, but of course nobody knows. So
All right.
We'll see what happens in 2020.
All right, then. For those of you who've joined us late, you know, this has been the Labor Exchange, and Dr. Ray Hoegler, professor of labor law, emeritus, and management emeritus at Colorado State University, was our guest with this subject. So, Ray, thank you for being on the Labor Exchange at KGNU. If you have any comments about this show or any other show on KGNU, please call 303-447-9911. And next week, Monday, December 2nd, 2019, please listen to La Lucha Sigue at 6 p.m. This has been the Labor Exchange, and I am Dennis Kreese for KGNU Community Radio. Sha-la-la-la, 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 sha-la-la-la.